This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everyone. This is Tracy Shoster, and today I'll be reading from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. Our first article for today, an album review. On the Tortured Poets Department, Taylor Swift could use an editor. Over 16 songs and a second LP, the pop superstar litigates her recent romances. But the themes and familiar sonic backdrops generate diminishing returns. If there has been a common thread, an invisible string, if you will, connecting the last few years of Taylor Swift's output, it has been abundance. Nearly 20 years into her career, Swift, now 34, is more popular and prolific than ever, sating her ravenous fan base and expanding her cultural domination with a near-constant stream of music. 5 new albums plus 4 re-recorded ones since 2019 alone. Her last LP, Midnights, from 2022, rolled out in multiple editions, each with its own extra songs and collectible covers. Her record-breaking Eras Tour is a 3.5-hour marathon featuring 40-plus songs, including the revised 10-minute version of her Lost Innocence ballad, All Too Well. In this imperial era of her long reign, Swift has operated under the guiding principle that more is more. What Swift reveals on her sprawling and often self-indulgent 11th LP, The Tortured Poets Department, is that this stretch of productivity and commercial success was also a tumultuous time for her, emotionally. Quote, "I can read your mind. She's having the time of her life," Swift sings on I Can Do It with a Broken Heart, a percolating track that evokes the glitter and adoration of the Eras Tour, but admits, quote, "All the pieces of me shattered as the crowd was chanting more." And yet that's exactly what she continues to provide, announcing 2 hours after the release of Poets that, surprise, there was a second volume of the album, the anthology, featuring 15 additional, though largely superfluous, tracks. Gone are the character studies and fictionalized narratives of Swift's 2020 folk pop albums Folklore and Evermore. The feverish, tortured poets department is a full-throated return to her specialty, autobiographical and sometimes spiteful tales of heartbreak, full of detailed referential lyrics that her fans will delight in decoding. Swift doesn't name names, but she drops plenty of bold-faced clues about exiting a long-term cross-cultural relationship that has grown cold, the wrenching So Long London, briefly taking up with a tattooed bad boy who raises the hackles of the more judgmental people in her life, the wild-eyed, but daddy, I love him, and starting fresh with someone who makes her sing in football metaphors, the weightless The Alchemy. The subject of the most headline-grabbing track on the anthology, a fellow member of the Tortured Billionaires Club, whom Swift reimagines as a high school bully, is right there in the title's odd capitalization. It's called Thank You, Amy, with thank, with the K capitalized, you, Amy, I am capitalized, which spells Kim. At times, the album is a return to form. Its first 2 songs are potent reminders of how viscerally Swift can summon the flushed delirium of a doomed romance. The opener, Fortnight, a pulsing synth-frosted duet with Post Malone, is chilly and controlled until lines like, I love you, it's ruining my life, inspire the song to thaw and glow. Even better is the chatty, radiant title track on which Swift's voice glides across smooth keyboard arpeggios, self-deprecatingly comparing herself and her lover to more daring poets before concluding, this ain't the Chelsea Hotel, we're modern idiots. Many Swift songs get lost in dense thickets of their own vocabulary, but here the goofy particularity of the lyrics, chocolate bars, first name nods to friends, a reference to the pop songwriter Charlie Pugh, is strangely humanizing. For all its sprawl, though, the Tortured Poets Department is a curiously insular album, often cradled in the familiar amniotic throb of Jack Antonoff's production, Aaron Dessner of The National, who lends a more muted and organic sensibility to Swift's sound, produced and helped write 5 tracks on the first album and the majority of the anthology. Antonoff and Swift have been working together since he contributed to her blockbuster album 1989 from 2014, and he has become her most consistent collaborator. There is a sonic uniformity to much of the Tortured Poets Department. However, gauzy backdrops, gently thumping synths, drum machine rhythms that lock Swift into a clipped chirping staccato that suggest their partnership has become too comfortable and risks growing stale. As the album goes on, Swift's lyricism starts to feel unrestrained, imprecise, and unnecessarily verbose. Breathless lines overflow and lead their melodies down circuitous paths. As they did on Midnights, internal rhymes multiply like resuscitations of dictionary pages. Camera flashes, welcome bashes, get the matches, toss the ashes off the ledge, she intones, in a bouncy cadence on Fresh Out of the Slammer, one of the several songs that lean too heavily on rote prison metaphors. Narcotic imagery is another inspiration for some of Swift's most trite and head-scratching writing. Florida, apparently, is one hell of a drug, if you say so. That song, though, is one of the album's best, a thunderous collaboration with pop sorceress Florence Welch, who blows in like a gust of fresh air and allows Swift to harness a more theatrical and dynamic aesthetic. Guilty as Sin, another lovely entry, is the rare Antonoff production that frames Swift's voice not in rigid electronics, but in a 90s soft rock atmosphere. On these tracks in particular, crisp Swiftian images emerge, an imagined lover's messy top lip kiss, 30-something friends who all smell like weed or little babies. It would not be a Swift album without an overheated and disproportionately scaled revenge song, and there is a doozy here called Who's Afraid of Little Old Me, which bristles with indignation over a grand, booming palate. Given the enormous cultural power that Swift wields, and the fact that she has played dexterously with humor and irony elsewhere in her catalog, it's surprising she doesn't deliver this one with a needed wink. Plenty of great artists are driven by feelings of being underestimated and have had to find new targets for their ire once they become too successful to convincingly claim underdog status. Beyoncé, who has reached a similar moment in her career, has opted to look outward. On her recently released Cowboy Carter, she takes aim at the racist traditionalists lingering in the music industry and the idea of genre as a means of confinement or limitation. Swift's new project remains fixed on her internal world. The villains of the Tortured Poets Department are a few less famous exes and, on the unexpectedly venomous But Daddy I Love Him, the wine moms and Sarahs and Hannahs in their Sunday best who cluck their tongues at our narrator's dating decisions. Some might speculate that these are actually shots at her own fans. The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived is probably the most satisfyingly vicious breakup song Swift has written since All Too Well, but it is predicated on a power imbalance that goes unquestioned. Is a clash between the smallest man and the biggest woman in the world a fair fight? That's a knotty question Swift might have been more keen to untangle on Midnights, an uneven LP that nonetheless found Swift asking deeper and more challenging questions about gender, power, and adult womanhood than she does here. It is to the detriment of the Tortured Poets Department that a certain starry-eyed fascination with fairy tales has crept back into Swift's lyricism. It is almost singularly focused on the salvation of romantic love. I tried to keep a tally of how many songs yearningly reference wedding rings and ran out of fingers. By the end, this perspective makes the album feel a bit hermetic, lacking the depth and taut structure of her best work. Swift has been promoting this poetry-themed album with hand-typed lyrics, sponsored library installations, and even an epilogue written in verse. A palpable love of language and a fascination with the ways words lock together in rhyme certainly courses through Swift's writing. But poetry is not a marketing strategy or even an aesthetic. It's a whole way of looking at the world and its language, turning them both upside down in search of new meanings and possibilities. It is also an art form in which, quite often and counter to the governing principle of Swift's current empire, less is more. Sylvia Plath once called poetry a tyrannical discipline because the poet must go so far and so fast in such a small space, you've got to burn away all the peripherals. Great poets know how to condense, or at least how to edit. The sharpest moments of the tortured poets department would be even more piercing in the absence of excess, but instead the clutter lingers while Swift holds an unlit match. Our next article, also from the arts section, original USS Enterprise model from Star Trek is returned to creator's son. The 33-inch model surfaced on eBay after disappearing decades ago. An auction house is giving it to the son of Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek. The first model of the USS Enterprise, the starship that appeared in the opening credits of the original Star Trek television series, has been returned to Eugene Roddenberry, the son of the creator of the series, decades after it went missing. "After a long journey, she's home," Mr. Roddenberry wrote on the social media on Thursday. For diehard Trekkies, the model's disappearance had become the subject of folklore. So an eBay listing last fall with a starting bid of $1,000 didn't go unnoticed. "Red alert," someone in an online costume and prop-making forum wrote, linking to the listing. Mr. Roddenberry's father, Gene Roddenberry, created the television series, which first aired in 1966 and ran for 3 seasons. It spawned numerous spinoffs, several films, and a franchise that has included conventions and legions of devoted fans with an avid interest in memorabilia. The sellers of the model were bombarded with inquiries and quickly took the listing down. The sellers contacted Heritage Auctions to authenticate it, the auction house's executive vice president, Joe Madalena, said on Saturday. As soon as the sellers, who said they had found it in a storage unit, brought it to the auction house's office in Beverly Hills, California, he said he knew it was real. "That's when I reached out to Rod to say, 'We've got this, this is it,'" he said, adding that the model was being transferred to Mr. Roddenberry. It was not clear what Mr. Roddenberry, who was traveling and could not immediately be reached, would do with the reclaimed model. It was also unclear how it got to the storage unit in the first place, and who had it before its discovery. The original USS Enterprise, a 33-inch model, was mostly made of solid wood by Richard C. Datton, a model maker for the Howard Anderson Company, a special effects company that created the opening credits for some of the 20th century's biggest TV shows. An enlarged 11-foot model was used in subsequent Star Trek television episodes and is now part of the permanent collection of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, where it was donated by Paramount Studios in 1974. Mr. Madalena said that Gene Roddenberry, who died in 1991, kept the original model, which appeared in the show's opening credits and pilot episode, on his desk. The model went missing after Mr. Roddenberry lent it to the makers of Star Trek: The Motion Picture, which was released in 1979. "This is a major discovery," he said, likening the model to the ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, a prop that was stolen in 2005 and recovered by the FBI in 2018, and that Heritage Auctions is selling. "While the slippers represent hope," he said, "the Starship Enterprise model represents dreams. It's a portal to what could be." Next up, from the book section, nonfiction, Salman Rushdie reflects on his stabbing in a new memoir. Knife is an account of the writer's brush with death in 2022 and the long recovery that followed. Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder by Salman Rushdie. So it's you, Salman Rushdie remembers thinking, on the morning of August 12th, 2022, as a black-clad man, a squat missile, sprinted toward him on an auditorium stage in Chautauqua, New York. Rushdie thought, here you are. 33 years had passed since the former supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa ordering the deaths of Rushdie and everyone involved in the publication of his 1988 novel, The Satanic Verses. It had been at least 2 decades since Rushdie stopped running. He had been living an almost normal life in New York City. Socially, he had become a giraffe, eating leaves from the tops of the highest trees, but he was seen in dive bars, too. The black-clad man was an apparition from an older, more punitive world, one Rushdie thought had largely forgotten about him. It is among that August morning's ironies that Rushdie was in Chautauqua to participate in a discussion about keeping the world's writers safe from harm. His attacker had pyrrhonic energy. He also had a knife. Too stunned to try to protect himself, Rushdie only raised his left hand. At first, some in the audience thought the scuffle was performance art. In his candid, plain-spoken, and gripping new memoir, Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder, Rushdie describes what happened next. The black-clad man, stabbing wildly, had 27 seconds alone with him. That is long enough, Rushdie points out, to read one of Shakespeare's sonnets, including his favorite, number 130. He does not print the poem, but I will, to provide a sense of the interminable horror. This is 27 seconds. My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun? If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. I have seen roses, damasked, red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground, and yet by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare. His attacker was at last subdued. Blood was everywhere, pooling. Rushdie's clothes were cut off him. His legs were raised to keep what blood he had left flowing to his heart. He remembers feeling humiliated. In the presence of serious injuries, your body's privacy ceases to exist, he writes. The reader considers it a good sign, for Rushdie's health and for the tone of this humane and often witty book, that among his first thoughts was, oh, my nice Ralph Lauren suit. A member of his surgery team later tells him, when they brought you in from the helicopter, we didn't think we could save you. Rushdie describes the appalling damage. There was the deep knife wound in my left hand, which severed all the tendons and most of the nerves. There were at least 2 more deep stab wounds in my neck, one slash right across it and more on the right side, and another farther up my face, also on the right. If I look at my chest now, I see a line of wounds down the center, 2 more slashes on the lower right side, and a cut on my upper right thigh. And there's a wound on the left side of my mouth, and there was one along my hairline, too. And there was the knife in the eye. That was the cruelest blow, and it was a deep wound. The blade went all the way into the optic nerve, which meant that there would be no possibility of saving the vision. It was gone. As bad as this was, he had been fortunate. A doctor says, you're lucky that the man who attacked you had no idea how to kill a man with a knife. This is Rushdie's second memoir. His first, Joseph Anton, the title refers to the pseudonym he used when in hiding, was published in 2012. Joseph Anton is a sophisticated and multi-layered book that recounts his years on the lam. It's a book about friendship, about the many people who took him in. It was also a book about divorce. He was in the process of separating from his second wife, the novelist Marion Wiggins, when the fatwa was announced. And during the book, his third marriage to Elizabeth West falls apart as well. Knife, on the other hand, contains a love story. Rushdie recounts meeting, wooing, and marrying the American poet and novelist Rachel Eliza Griffiths, 3 decades his junior. She is now Lady Rushdie. Her husband was knighted in 2007 for services to literature. Their story adds buoyancy to this memoir, but it takes a long time for that light to pour in. First, there will be arduous recovery and rehab. The poet John Berryman said an artist is lucky when presented with the worst possible ordeal which will not actually kill him. At that point, he's in business. This is cynical, but true. I've rarely read about worse physical trauma. Rushdie is initially held together by staples. His ruined eye bulged out of its socket and hung down his face like a large soft-boiled egg. He spends time on ventilators. There were small bags attached to his body to gather a variety of leaking fluids. No one will permit him to look in a mirror. Mentally, he tortures himself. Why had he not defended himself? Was it that he was 75 and his attacker was 24? On some days, I'm embarrassed, even ashamed, by my failure to try to fight back, he writes. On other days, I tell myself not to be stupid. What do I imagine I could have done? This is as close to understanding my inaction as I've been able to get. The targets of violence experience a crisis in their understanding of the real. This is not, it must be said, the most elegant book. It does not have the emotional, intellectual, and philosophical richness of the journalist Philippe Lancon's memoir, Disturbance, from 2019, about surviving the 2015 Charlie Hebdo magazine attacks by thugs claiming allegiance to Al-Qaeda. But Rushdie was wise to largely stick to the details and stay out of his story's way. To paraphrase Roy Blunt Jr., I put this book down only once or twice to wipe off the sweat. During Rushdie's convalescence, his friend Martin Amis died. Another friend, the editor and food writer Bill Buford, nearly expired from heart problems. Another, Paul Auster, discovered he had cancer. There have been many times since the attack, Rushdie writes, when I have thought that death was hovering over the wrong people. His mind, a free associating unit, is intact. The literary and film references in Knife run deep. Along the way, we learn that Rushdie is a Law and Order fan, that against his better judgment, he orders books from Amazon, and that he needed the Chautauqua check to pay for a new air conditioning system, and so forth. Humor bubbles up organically from pain. Dear reader, if you have never had a catheter inserted into your genital organ, do your very best to keep that record intact, he writes. He enjoys that one of his surgeons has the improbably gastronomic name of James Baird. His account of a prostate exam includes these lines, "Ah, double ah, even more ah." He is self-deprecating about his weight, which was 240 pounds at the time of the attack. He lost 55 pounds in the months that followed. He does not recommend his weight loss technique. He no longer has any urge, he writes, to defend the satanic verses or himself, although renunciation is the last thing on his mind. If anyone's looking for remorse, he writes early on, you can stop reading right here. Near the end of this memoir, there is a sharp pivot. Throughout, Rushdie has provided pellets of information about his hostile and ill-informed attacker, whom he chooses to refer to as the A, instead of the less decorous label, the ass, he would prefer to use. Before the attack, the A had been to Chautauqua for several nights, sleeping rough, checking out the site. He carried a false ID, his fake name, an amalgam of the names of the well-known Shia Muslims extremists. He had been living in his mother's basement in New Jersey, playing video games and watching Netflix. He'd been radicalized by YouTube videos and, his mother suspected, by a trip to Lebanon in 2018. Rushdie decides against trying to speak to him face to face. Instead, he imagines an interview with him, a conversation that consumes 30 pages of this book. I will not give the contents of this imagined interview away, except to say that the topics include radicalization, the ruthlessness that comes with the blinkered conviction that your cause is just, translation, hatred, laughter, literacy, gym memberships, mothers, and the New York Giants. Rushdie is no Oriana Fallaci and no Tom Stoppard. I am not sure this section entirely comes off, but I am still processing it. Their fictional exchange did put me in mind of a bitter line from Lancôme's book, uttered by the satirical cartoonist Stephanie Jean-Abel-Michel Garbonnier, better known as Charb. If we start respecting people who don't respect us, we might as well close up shop. Knife is a clarifying book. It reminds us of the threats the free world faces. It reminds us of the things worth fighting for. Rushdie's friend, Christopher Hitchens, in the wake of the initial fatwa, eloquently explained the stakes. The affair drew a line between everything I hated versus everything I loved, he wrote. In the hate column, dictatorship, religion, stupidity, demagogy, censorship, bullying, and intimidation. In the love column, literature, irony, humor, the individual, and the defense of free expression. His words apply to this book. Many questions are left at the close of Knife. It is uncertain if Rushdie will lose the sight in his remaining eye because of macular degeneration. It is unclear where Rushdie and Griffiths will choose to live. But the mood of this book is suggested by this line about going out to a restaurant for the first time since the attack. After the angel of death, the angel of life. Well, we only have like a minute or two left, so we're going to stop here for today. Thanks for joining me as I read from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. Until next time, this is Tracy Shoster. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day today.